loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at several big stories in our regular Friday hour-long segment called The Week in Review. We discuss Donald Trump's announcement today that he'll sign the funding bill and that he has declared a national emergency. We dive into the ongoing coup attempt in Venezuela, including the event yesterday where the Venezuelan foreign minister spoke with the support of a new group of 50 countries who support the elected Venezuelan government. This was a story which was not covered in the mainstream media. And we talk about the sudden decision by Amazon's chief executive Jeff Bezos to stop plans to build a second headquarters in New York after community and union opposition to those plans and to the tax giveaway provided by New York City and New York State.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Today is Susan B. Anthony Day, a day to celebrate women's suffrage and to commemorate the birth of one of the most important leaders in the history of that movement. So far, 6 states celebrate Susan B. Anthony Day, which is not yet recognized on a national level. Congress blocked the sale of weapons to Turkish President Erdogan's security team until action is taken against the security agents charged with assaulting U.S. protesters in 2017. Congress also required a report from the Defense Department on the consequences of Turkey receiving a Russian S-400 missile system, and until then, the delivery of American F-35 jets has been blocked. A suicide car bombing targeting members of India's paramilitary Central Reserve Police Force killed more than 40 soldiers yesterday. Today, the diplomatic fallout continues as India blames Pakistan for facilitating the attack. The bombing took place in the disputed region of Kashmir, where there's a long-standing insurgency demanding either independence or unification with Pakistan. Bill Weld, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts, announced that he is considering a primary challenge to Donald Trump next year. Weld said, quote, "Our president is simply too unstable to carry out the duties of the highest executive office in the land," unquote. Weld is widely considered to be a libertarian Republican politically. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to President Trump's announcement that he is declaring a national emergency to get funding to build the wall after Congress refused his demands. We're going to talk about this in this segment called The Week in Review. We have this segment every Friday where we look at the big issues of the week in politics, policy, and international affairs. We're joined in studio by Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can hear their live stream every week on Facebook and at YouTube. And we're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst and producer of this show, Loud and Clear. Jackie, there's a national emergency. We learned that earlier this morning from the president. Donald Trump, in declaring this national emergency, said this: whether it's $8 billion or $2 billion, or $1.5 billion, it's going to build a lot of wall. We're getting it done. Close quote.
Oh, listen.
You don't look like you believe that the country is in a state of emergency.
Let me tell you what the state of emergency really is. The state of emergency is the state of Black America in the United States. That's the real national emergency. We would love to get $8 billion or $1.5 billion or $2 billion for a Marshall Plan for Black America that the Urban League has been documenting for a decade, 2 decades. But no, he's getting $1.5 billion, $1.47 billion to build 50 miles of a fence on the U.S. border to address a crisis that does not exist.
John, there's all these reports of people, reporters going to border towns and where the wall will be, this big, ugly wall that will separate what was a beautiful space, a beautiful vista. And the people at the border are saying, what national crisis? What crisis even? I mean, they're at the epicenter if there was a crisis.
The crisis is that the federal government is going to begin stealing people's land through eminent domain.
To build the wall.
To build this wall. And don't forget, this wall is not going to be on the border, right? It's not like you're looking at a map and then you just run it along the line that constitutes the border. It's going to be 100, 150, 200 yards inside the United States. Well, people live on that land. People farm that land. In many cases, it's been in their families for many generations. And now it's going to be divided into something small that they're allowed to keep, and then a no man's land between the United States and Mexico that nobody's allowed to ever go on again. Jackie pointed out something that was very important just before we started this segment, that it's also going to bifurcate an important butterfly sanctuary where endangered butterflies, they go to multiply and lay their eggs or whatever it is they do. There's a church that's going to be cut right in half. The wall is going to go right through the center of this church. A lot of people are going to be disrupted. A lot of lives, a lot of families are going to be disrupted. And Jackie made another important point. The lawsuits have already been written. They were written weeks ago, and they were just waiting for the president to make a decision so that they can file these lawsuits against the government in federal court to stop this stupid idea.
Well, let me ask you about this, because, John, you are in government. You were in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. You studied government. You know how the government actually functions, the rules, the regulations. The Constitution is quite clear. The power of the purse, that is of budgeting, belongs to the U.S. Congress. Donald Trump did not succeed with the U.S. Congress giving him what he wanted, and now he's declared a national emergency to get the funding that he wanted but didn't get from Congress. I mean, is it legal?
I think it's not legal, and I think that it's going to be bottled up very quickly at the district court level. It'll then be appealed to the circuit court level, and I think the chances are very good that the administration will lose there. And that's before the Supreme Court even considers whether or not it should take on the issue. But the point you make, Brian, is an important one. It's simple, but it's important. And that is that Congress controls the purse. That's it.
The other issue with this whole national emergency thing is that Trump is told that he has the ability to redirect existing funds from already funded government agencies to pay for his wall. And one of the pots of money that was identified was the Department of Defense, which I don't have a problem with anybody taking money from the Department of Defense. But the irony in taking that particular money is that the money that's targeted is already earmarked for drug interdiction. And if this wall is supposed to be built to protect Americans from the scourge and the onslaught of illegal drugs being brought into the country in backpacks by illegal aliens, which we know that's not why we have an opioid epidemic. That's not why we have the scale of the drug problem in this country that we do. If this wall is there to combat drugs, why are we taking money from operations that exist to combat drugs? It's very odd.
Let's listen to Trump. This was kind of a bizarre press conference where he made this announcement, but let's hear an audio clip from it.
I'm going to be signing a national emergency, and it's been signed many times before. It's been signed by other presidents from 1977 or so. It gave the presidents the power. There's rarely been a problem. They sign it. Nobody cares. I guess they weren't very exciting, but nobody cares. They sign it for far less important things in some cases, in many cases. We're talking about an invasion of our country with drugs, with human traffickers, with all types of criminals and gangs.
Okay, John.
Wow. I mean, how do you even begin to comment on something like that? First of all, he lives in a dream world and he knows it. He's trying to make this sound like it's no big deal. It's a very big deal. Yeah, there have been a lot of national emergencies declared in the last 35 or 40 years. But there are things like the response to 9/11 or Reagan's war on drugs or the Iran hostage crisis. I mean, these are serious crises that we've, or the aftermath to some terrible hurricane, let's say. But there's no crisis on the border. There never has been any crisis on the border. Everybody knows it. Republican members of Congress who represent border districts are saying it in public now. They're bucking their party leadership to come out and say it in public. He really doesn't have a leg to stand on. He's not going to convince the American people. I mean, people are generally ill-informed, I think, just normally, but they're not stupid.
Well,
usually
people who are not his rabid base are not.
But at the same time,
and that's
courts,
who he's talking to.
Yeah, but the courts and the politicians certainly know that this is made up. Mitch McConnell yesterday just said that the president was going to declare a national emergency and that he urged him in the strongest possible terms not to. And then John Cornyn, who's the number two Republican in the Senate, said that there's no way this is going to make its way through the courts.
Let's play another audio clip from Trump's press conference this morning. This is an exchange between Trump and a reporter from MSNBC. Let's listen.
Let's go. Let's hear it, NBC. Come
Thank you, Mr. President. I just want to say, when in the past, when President Obama tried to use executive action as it related to immigration, you said the whole concept of executive order, it's not the way the country's supposed to be run. You said you're supposed to go through Congress and make a deal. Will you concede that you were unable to make the deal that you had promised in the past and that the deal you're ending up with now from Congress is less than what you could have had before a 35-day shutdown?
I went through Congress. I made a deal. I got almost $1.4 billion when I wasn't supposed to get $1. Not $1. He's not going to get $1. Well, I got $1.4 billion, but I'm not happy with it. I also got billions and billions of dollars for other things. Port of entries, lots of different things. The purchase of drug equipment. More than we were even requesting. In fact, the primary fight was on the wall. Everything else, we have so much, as I said, I don't know what to do with it. We have so much money. But on the wall, they skimped. So I did, I was successful in that sense, but I want to do it faster. I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this, but I'd rather do it much faster.
I didn't need to do this, and yet it is a national emergency requiring the president to take immediate action. So
he can't think 5 seconds ahead.
That seems contradictory. I didn't need to do it, and yet it's a national emergency. Go ahead, Jackie.
Why are you asking me to try to make sense of this? I cannot make sense of this.
I can understand why everybody's a little bit speechless right now, but we are a radio show, so we have to keep talking. I mean, it makes you speechless listening to Trump. He said, I got a lot of money. I made a deal. I got a lot of money. More than we actually need.
More money than I even know what to do with.
More than money than I know what to do
with. Well, if that's true, why did you need to declare a national emergency to get the more he talks, the more questions. Oh, I can't.
Or shut down the government and like completely screw over like hundreds of thousands of families who lost their income. I mean, it's so outrageous. I didn't need to do this. Well, then, I mean, wow.
John, so what you're predicting is that it will go to the courts.
And it'll be bottled up there.
It'll be bottled up. But, you know, Jackie mentioned in the beginning there is a crisis in the country. There's several crises.
Yeah.
The crisis she mentioned is the state of Black America. There's a crisis for all those immigrant families. I mean, people have a legal right to seek asylum. And right now we have a situation where thousands of people, many, many thousands of people are incarcerated because they're trying to seek asylum. We have a mandate, a bed mandate. Tens of thousands of people are mandated to go to prisons, and those prisons are profitable. That seems like a real crisis to me.
Oh, I agree. I mean, my goodness, there are many crises that the country faces right now. Poverty, homelessness, the environment, infrastructure. I mean, infrastructure was supposed to be something that Donald Trump was going to get behind, right? That was going to be the grand compromise with the Democrats, was supposed to be this national multi-billion-dollar infrastructure bill. And nothing's come of any of this. And don't forget that the Republicans controlled the White House and both houses of Congress for 2 years, and they accomplished almost nothing. They have nothing to show for it except tax cuts for the rich. And that's all they can point to.
And let me just add real quick that what this actually does, what Trump declaring a national emergency for this thing that isn't a national emergency, whether he's successful with it or not, it sets a precedent for every other president who comes after him, regardless of who it is, regardless of what party they represent, to use this to get what they want when they can't get it through Congress. And he was warned not to do this for this reason. But his ego is way bigger than the Oval Office. So here we are.
Let's turn to another story. Amazon, the company owned by Jeff Bezos, who also owns the Washington Post, also has a $600 million contract with the CIA and a looming $10 billion contract with the Pentagon, has announced that even though New York City and New York State were giving Amazon big, big tax bonuses to as a lure to bring them to Queens, New York, that Bezos has decided, no, we're not going to do that in Queens. We're not going to do it in New York. Apparently, he has a very thin skin because a lot of people in Queens, in Long Island City, in New York raise concerns about and opposition to such a giveaway to this richest corporation and richest man in the world.
Yeah, the problem with this Amazon deal in New York is the same problem with the Amazon deal in Virginia, which they've already agreed upon. Virginia has already passed the resolution and to give Amazon the incentives, was that the Amazon headquarters in New York was going to be built next to like the country's largest housing development. But the 25,000 alleged 25,000 jobs that were they claimed that they were going to create, most of those were not going to be higher paying jobs that the residents of that area were going to get. Most of those jobs were going to be imported. They already exist, and Amazon employees somewhere else were going to relocate to this location. And then Amazon or Bezos and his negotiation team did not want the employees of the warehouse to unionize. They didn't want to pay employees of the new warehouse $15 an hour, did not want them to unionize. And so rightfully so, the people in this already economically depressed neighborhood knew that they were going to be pushed out by Amazon. And they said, no, we don't want you coming in, basically kicking us out of our neighborhoods.
There's one other thing too, a postscript to this whole thing is now the pro Amazon people in New York, in a fit of sour grapes, are saying, well, the headquarters was going to be built on a toxic waste site and Amazon was going to clean it all up. They were literally, I just read this, they were literally creating green jobs, and now you liberals have ruined everything. So we have to live with this toxic waste dump.
That's a ridiculous, ridiculous supposition. If New York had $3 billion in tax incentives to give Amazon, then they could just take that money and clean up the toxic waste.
Besides the fact that it's the EPA's responsibility and the EPA has a massive budget for doing that exactly too. That.
You could do a lot with $3 billion.
Yes, you can.
Besides give it to Jeff Bezos, you could help the subway. Mm-hmm. The subway is... could do with a little modernization.
You could close down Rikers Island and build a decent humanitarian place to hold people.
Provide affordable housing.
Right. And you could also use that money to help, you know, the 10% of New York City school children. We talk about this statistic a lot, 10% of New York City school children who experienced homelessness, you know, at some point in 2017, I believe is the year that was from. I mean, you know, New York City is a city of unbelievable inequality. You know, there's such desperate poverty juxtaposed with Wall Street. I mean, that's the home of the biggest banks and corporations, some of the biggest banks and corporations in the world. And so, you know, yeah, here is another $3 billion giveaway, you know, not unlike the, you know, many hundreds of billions of dollars that the, you know, banks on Wall Street got, that, you know, the working people in Queens would not benefit from at all. No working class person in New York City would benefit from that. In fact, their rent would just go up.
And, oh, yeah.
You know, the rent in New York is already just astronomical. I mean, it's like completely impossible for ordinary people to pay rent and also buy, you know, all of the necessities they need for a decent life.
The promise of the 25,000 jobs was only until, I think, 2028, too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so the New York was going to give Bezos $3 billion for what would be a promise for 9 years. And again, it doesn't mean that these would be new jobs. They could also be bringing people who make high salaries to New York City, to Queens.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, that would also, of course, have the impact of raising rents, mortgages, etc. You know what strikes me about the whole thing is you have the mayor of New York, powerful position. You have the governor of New York, very powerful position. Bottom line is the decisions about what gets built and what doesn't get built in a place like New York City in with this powerful political establishment is not the elected representatives of the people.
Right.
This is the tyranny of capital. Amazon, the ultra rich, they get to decide what goes up and what doesn't go up. Again, it says a lot about our democracy that there's no reigning in these forces. They decide.
Yeah, especially when you have Cuomo, who I think he was being facetious, but I think it's also indicative of exactly what you said. He's running around willing to call himself Amazon Cuomo in order to court.
Yeah, he said he would change his name
to
Amazon Cuomo.
He would change his name to Amazon Cuomo. I mean, he didn't want to call himself, you know, bus driver Cuomo. He didn't want to call himself transportation worker Cuomo, teacher Cuomo.
You're making a very important point because this is a guy who has presidential ambitions. He just came through a primary, and he put his entire reputation on the line for this thing, and it went up in a puff of smoke. So he's essentially lost control over the progressive wing of the New York Democratic Party, and that's going to be a very big problem for him. They already didn't trust him, and that's why he had a primary challenger from the left.
There's another reason, Walter, why this is the tyranny of capital. All these politicians pandered to Bezos.
Absolutely.
They got down, they pandered to him, willing to change their name, obviously, for him in terms of Governor Cuomo. They're willing to offer Bezos $3 billion. And then Bezos says, nope, we're not going to do it. We're walking away. It's a message from Amazon to other cities. Don't you dare allow political leaders to hear the voices of the downtrodden. Don't you dare let them hear the voices of the unions or of the community groups. Don't you dare listen to them. If you don't listen to us, and if you don't do what we say, we'll screw you. And that's the message here. I mean, it really is a kind of mafia tactic, and they can do it overnight. And then Bezos is going to go on and negotiate with other cities about all kinds of things, and the other cities know, don't mess with Jeff Bezos.
Right, and Jeff Bezos also owns the Washington Post. So, I mean, there's another whole element of how democracy is distorted by the enormous power of big money, because not only is there the phenomena that you talked about where, you know, the economic leverage of these massive corporations and CEOs are able to basically blackmail politicians and communities. Well, the politicians are usually happy to go along with it, but blackmail communities into basically accepting, you know, the worst possible deal, right? There's a race to the bottom, is the natural consequence of that logic. And then there's also, you know, the control of the flow of information by just a handful of monopoly corporations, and increasingly so, a handful of just super rich individuals like Jeff Bezos, who now owns, you know, one of the most important newspapers in the country, really in the world, even has a major role in shaping public opinion because of the way that the media is sort of structured, right? It's kind of one of the flagships. And so, you know, the influence goes, you know, pervades all the different corners of society.
Before we move on to another issue, I want to stay with the Amazon story a little bit more, because right now, real estate interests in New York are up in arms. They're saying, how could this have happened? How did we let this happen? This was the golden goose has been driven out of town. So they're up in arms. But, you know, there's something else about the story. Amazon actually doesn't lose anything.
Nothing. Literally nothing.
They don't lose at all. In fact, Amazon still gains. How do they gain? I'm going to read a couple sentences from today's Wall Street Journal. Amazon's plans for a New York City headquarters may not have panned out, but its search for a second campus may have provided the e-commerce company with invaluable information at a cost that will barely register on its giant balance sheet. Now, this is the underreported part of the story. The Seattle-based company's year-long search for a second headquarters, including the now jilted site in Long Island City, Queens, supplied executives with a trove of data and a blueprint for expansion across some of the largest metropolitan areas in the country. This stockpile of logistical planning and demographic data, expansive dossiers on cities such as Atlanta, Boston, and Denver, could inform Amazon's decisions about where to place warehouses and data centers, invest in facilities, and develop regional hubs of employees, according to experts and analysts. I hadn't thought about that.
No, that wouldn't have occurred to me.
Every city, while they were in this bidding process, gave Amazon complete sort of access to every potential data point about where that city, that region, that metro area was going. That's all now in the possession of Amazon. I mean, if they had to have paid for that, that would have been very, very expensive. But instead, in this competitive bidding, the cities got on their knees and gave Amazon everything they wanted.
Wow, that's amazing. I hadn't considered that either, but it makes perfect sense. And right, I mean, yeah, data is sort of everything for Amazon. Yeah, that's pretty shocking. You know, it also shows that because Amazon has the capacity as a national corporation and a global corporation, of course, it has the capacity to go across borders to sort of, you know, pit different people in different localities against each other. I think it just speaks to, you know, the necessity of organizing on the same scale, right? That Amazon, that's sort of the enemies of ordinary people. people they organize on as well.
We have about 4.5 minutes before we go to break. Then after our break, we're going to continue in this segment called The Week in Review. We look at the big issues of the week. But let's turn to Venezuela. Of course, we know that the U.S. coup effort against the Maduro government, the elected government of Venezuela, is still ongoing, but it's not going very well. And yesterday, the foreign minister of Venezuela held a meeting at the United Nations with 50 countries standing with the Maduro government, 50 countries, including Russia and China. I looked at the Wall Street Journal today, the New York Times, the other mainstream media. Not a single word about this massive display of solidarity with the besieged government of Venezuela. Nothing. But guess what? It's happening.
The media blackout of the support of the democratically elected government. Let's just take Maduro's name, because people are making such a big deal about, oh, you know, Maduro is a bad guy. He might indeed be a bad leader. But the point is, he was elected by 6 million people in Venezuela. There's no such thing as the elections in Venezuela being illegitimate. Venezuelan elections are some of the most trusted elections in the world. And the idea that the United States media is still acting as if everyone in Venezuela is against Maduro and trying to garner the support around the world to get rid of a democratically elected leader because they're making Maduro into the bad guy. It's the epitome of this fake news that Trump continues to talk about, that he says is weaponized against them. But American media is actually doing that to support this coup.
Walter, I'm just guessing that the 2.5 million people who got free homes built by the Maduro-led government, working class and poor people, are probably not part of the demonstrations opposing his government.
No, and in fact, they've been in demonstrations supporting the government because, you know, just to explain what you're referring to, there's something called the Great Housing Mission Venezuela, which was one of the key initiatives of the Venezuelan, of the Maduro administration, right? After Hugo Chavez died in 2013, Nicolas Maduro was elected and then reelected. You know, there's this program that began as a way to give relief to people who are victims of like major landslides. But then as they were building these homes, they decided, well, hey, there's a lot of people in Venezuela who need homes, right? Who, you know, don't have dignified housing, you know, fit for a decent life. So we're just going to keep going. And so, you know, 2.5 million homes. So the population of Venezuela is about 30 million. So if you adjust for population, that would be like the government of the United States building, you know, like 25 million homes and just giving it away to working class people for free. Like, that's what the government of Venezuela does. And you know what? They were able to do that because they retook control of their country's oil wealth. And, you know, there's a major economic problems in Venezuela because the price of oil has collapsed, right, compared to where it was, say, you know, 5-6 years ago. But, you know, there's still these social programs that go on. You know, that's the very last thing to be cut are social programs. It's the complete opposite set of priorities as our government has.
What we're witnessing with Maduro, because it's sort of a thing that everybody says, you don't have to support Maduro, but you shouldn't be for intervention. You know, I'm starting to hear that all over the place. It's kind of like a talking point. So I'm starting to ask people, what is it in particular that you don't actually like about Maduro? Because when you ask people these things, they actually don't know exactly what it means. Now, Boots Riley, the filmmaker who made Sorry to Bother You,
one of my favorite movies,
and also in the group The Coup, he sent out a tweet that said, "The next Mission Impossible villain will be a socialist president of a South American country who implements universal health care and free education, but is secretly evil." I mean, it's perfect. Anyway, we're going to keep talking about Venezuela when we come back from a break. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
We're talking about the big issues of the week in this segment called The Week in Review. We're speaking with Jacqueline Lookman. She's the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can hear their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Jackie, Walter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Let's keep talking about Venezuela, a coup that's not going that well. Not that surprising, given the fact that nobody in Venezuela knew who Juan Guaido was.
And many still don't.
Right.
And they still don't. Like, even though he's now the announced president of Venezuela, recognized by the Lima Group, and most importantly, by Trump's cabinet, and even though they've given him all the money that they've seized from Venezuela, one of these big loots, looting one of the big heists of modern history. In the case of the UK, they took $1.2 billion of Venezuela's gold and are giving it to the opposition. Like, here, Juan, here's $1.2 billion in your country's gold. Meanwhile, Juan Guaido, like Trump, keeps talking about all options are on the table, seeming to suggest that he's inviting military operations against his own country and own people. Again, though, not going that well. And what I think is important is the psychological war that's being waged against the Venezuelan government. Like, did you heard that story, China's meeting with Juan Guaido. The Maduro allies are defecting. We were told initially the military would split apart, but the military has stayed strong. Life in Caracas and the other cities of Venezuela is normal. By the way, everybody, if it's a terrible dictatorship, why are there demonstrations against Maduro one day and demonstrations for Maduro the next day? They're not suppressed.
Enormous ones.
Right.
Enormous ones on both sides.
Yeah.
The vast majority of the press hates Nicolas Maduro and writes about it every single day.
Yeah. So where's the, you mean the Venezuelan media?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's privately owned right-wing media. Where is the dictatorship? Where is the dictatorship is because Venezuela is trying to go a different road and to be independent from the United States and use its vast oil resources to improve the lives of working class Venezuelans. That's the reality. Are there economic problems? Yes. What's the main cause of them? Two things. One, the economic sanctions, whereby it's almost impossible to sell Venezuelan oil, that Venezuela's assets have been frozen. And the other big part of the problem is that there's a capital strike, meaning the ruling capitalist class in Venezuela is deliberately holding goods back, hoarding goods so that there are shortages. That's a real thing. That happens, and it's designed to create economic unhappiness, or as Kissinger said, make the economy scream, as a precursor to overthrowing the government. It's not a new idea. That's what the U.S. does when it's about to overthrow governments, is it economically destabilizes them in cahoots with the country's own elites.
And the thing that is interesting about the American media or the Western media calling Maduro this evil, evil dictator. Well, if he's an evil dictator, why is he calling for elections? I mean, he literally made a speech the other day and said, oh, OK, fine. The opposition wants elections. Then let's have elections. He said that into a microphone in public in front of thousands and upon thousands of supporters of his democratically elected government. I mean, if he's an evil dictator, as the Western media has said that he's denying the entry of U.S. aid, well, that's not true because he actually requested aid from the United Nations last year. But he also recognizes that this push to get U.S. aid into the country specifically from the United States is just another part of this propaganda war.
It is notable that Donald Trump has appointed Elliot Abrams to be his envoy to Venezuela. There's different pieces of this. One is, I want to talk about who Elliot Abrams is, the reaction to him, because when he testified before a House committee this week, there was a protest, and we actually talked to one of the people who was a truth teller there, one of the protesters. But there's also some report, I think it's an AP story with Nicolas Maduro, about a possible discussion between the Maduro government and Elliot Abrams. But let's start first with the hearing itself. Here's a clip. I think this is the people who were protesting at Elliot Abrams' hearing.
Thank you for the opportunity to testify on our efforts to restore democracy in Venezuela.
Don't listen to war criminals.
Hold on.
Elliot Abrams supported genocide in Iraq.
Our military intervention.
Elliot Abrams is going to
going to send weapons to Venezuelan right-wing factions to cause a genocide like he did in Guatemala and El Salvador. Join Code Pink and Answer Coalition.
Okay.
All right. That sounded good. That was Ariel Gold and Kay Pritzker. She from Code Pink, he from the Answer Coalition. We interviewed Kay afterwards. He was arrested. They got out. I want to go to another audio clip. It's from a congressperson, Adriano Espaillat. He's talking or asking Abrams questions. Let's listen.
Many of our allies have expressed concern of your appointment to deal with this problem. Some have characterized it as being perhaps like appointing Exxon to lead a discussion on the Green New Deal, or maybe even appointing MBS to lead a discussion on fairness in journalism and accessibility to journalism. Do you feel that your past actions in Iran-Contra have permanently impair your ability to fairly and transparently deal in the region, since we all know the outcome of what happened then? Do you feel that that's a major problem, baggage that you bring to the table?
I don't, and I've been doing this job for 2 whole weeks, and I can tell you that members of Congress have raised it. No Latin American of any nationality with whom I have dealt has raised it. We've had lots and lots of discussions about how we're going to promote democracy in Venezuela. I guess I should say, since I've been attacked now 3 times in my own defense, if you look at the Reagan record of 8 years, when we came in, there were military dictatorships all over
Latin America. Mr. Abrams, that's not an attack. That's a fact of history.
And when we left, in country after country after country, there had been transitions that we supported. Chile is a very good example. So I think it's actually a record of promoting democracy, and I think a lot of Latins know that.
I differ with you. I think it's a fact of history. We should not dig our heads in the sand and make believe that this never happened, because it did, and you were at the helm of that. And
I was at the helm of promoting democracy in Latin America.
You may want to characterize it that way, but I don't. I think you were involved in the Iran-Contra deal, and I think that permanently damages you to be a fair and impartial arbiter.
The congressperson was making the point, and again, I think even the opposition to Elliot Abrams is a bit soft, frankly, but they're trying to, you know, use the medium of asking questions to make points. Elliot Abrams said he thought it was great that the U.S. brought democracy to Chile. I mean, the government in Chile was a democratically elected socialist government that was trying to use nonviolent means to legislate socialism in through the electoral and parliamentary process. The CIA deliberately crushed their economy, worked with generals, overthrew the government. 30,000 people were executed, and Pinochet, war criminal, became the dictator of Chile. That's who Elliot Abrams says is the great Democrat in Chile that he helped bring to power.
Unfortunately, this kind of history is almost never conveyed in a real clear sense by our elected officials. I was saying earlier, I understand how it happens, but it sickens me that the same criminal, shady, and in this instance, yeah, absolute war criminals are recycled in our government. It's appalling that someone like Elliot Abrams, who is directly responsible for the deaths of 30,000 people in Chile, of almost 80,000 people in El Salvador, can sit in front of a congressional committee and celebrate his involvement in these horrific crimes against humanity and say that they were accomplishments for the advancement of democracy.
Go ahead, Walter.
And let's not forget about Guatemala either, where, you know, he backed the military regime that carried out a genocide against indigenous people. I mean, there's so much here. And you know what, if you read the big newspapers around the time of the coup against Allende in Chile, which brought to power Pinochet, someone who became, you know, synonymous with murder and torture and dictatorship all around the world, you know, unleashed this brutal regime, massacred thousands of people in the national stadium in Chile right after the coup happened. You know, he just rounded up all his political opponents and he executed them in the stadium. If you read the newspapers about Allende and then about Pinochet, they sound a lot like they do today about Nicolas Maduro, right? Oh, you know, the economy's in shambles. Socialism has destroyed the economy. Somebody needs to step in and restore order and save the country. And then the media in 1973 in Chile after the coup, they applauded. They said this was great. Pinochet was going to save Chile from communism. And you know what? The Chilean media was even worse because one of the main corporate media outlets, El Mercurio, their front page headline the day after the coup took place was "Marxist rats exterminated." This is how, it's the exact same phenomenon, right? The right-wing politicians in the United States, extreme right-wing elements and elites in that country and the corporate media all working together to destroy democracy and impose dictatorship and destroy all the progressive gains that those democratically elected governments have instituted.
I want to turn to Elliot Abrams on one other issue here, and that is that according to an interview, I believe it's Associated Press with Nicolas Maduro, directed his foreign minister to actually have a secret negotiation with Elliot Abrams. Even this week, the foreign minister was here at the UN. We mentioned in the first segment that 50 countries came together to stand with him in solidarity with him and the Maduro government against the U.S. coup. But yeah, it looks like they had a secret meeting with Elliot Abrams. I think it was after Elliot Abrams had actually said there's no more room for or time for negotiations between the United States and Venezuela. Why do you think the Venezuelan government would be meeting with Elliot Abrams? And why would Elliot Abrams be meeting with Maduro's government after he said there can no longer be negotiations?
Well, I mean, I think on Venezuela's part, the calculation they're making is that they have to exploit every possible division within the U.S. government, within the enemy camp, right? I mean, it's a standard practice in politics. And I think that, even though Elliot Abrams is the most revolting person alive, of course you have to pursue that strategy. Of course you have to try to divide, people who might think that, oh, this is going too far, or somebody like Donald Trump, who is, a complete wild card, and who knows what you're going to get from that guy. So yeah, I mean, they're carrying these out, and in parallel, they're also preparing for the possibility of a war too. I mean, to defend their country. The United States, why would Elliot Abrams do that? I think it's because they know that, the military isn't split like they wanted it to. The opposition, they're organizing large demonstrations, but it's not like it's, overthrowing the government. I mean, it's not like preventing daily life from going on in Venezuela. And so, maybe they want to just probe and sort of see, what might be possible.
John, I think it was noteworthy that Maduro actually acknowledged that the foreign minister did met twice with Elliot Abrams in New York while the foreign minister was here in New York. And again, we're trying to understand why they're doing it, why Abrams is doing it, why the government of Venezuela is doing it. Here's what Maduro told the AP. If Abrams wants to meet, just tell me when, where, and how, and I'll be there, the AP quoted Maduro as saying. Venezuela's foreign minister, again, according to a Reuters article, met twice with Abrams in New York for several hours and invited him to come to Venezuela, quote, privately, publicly, or secretly, close quote, Maduro said in the AP interview. Okay, so what's going on, John?
I was fascinated by this. It tells me several things. It tells me that the Trump administration is operating from a position of weakness, because if they were operating from a position of strength, there would be no reason to meet with Nicolas Maduro or anybody else. This coup is not working. And so the Trump White House is trying to save face. Secondly, the fact that Maduro went public with this in a formal interview with AP shows that he has hit this political ball right back into Donald Trump's court. He said, I'm willing to meet. Your coup is failing. Let's fix this. Now, in the end, Maduro may have to make some sort of concessions, but I think he's going to survive this thing. And I think that he has out-politicked Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's obvious by the acknowledgement in public, as you're saying, John, by Maduro himself.
Mm-hmm.
He said, yeah, we met with Elliot Abrams. We met with him twice. And also, we told him he can come to Venezuela and talk anytime. Now, Elliot Abrams met with them after he said the time has long passed. I think that's his exact quote for negotiations, except to organize the surrender of Maduro or sending him to Guantanamo. Or, no,
right.
That was Bolton who was saying.
Right.
but I agree with John. I think this is an example. Diplomacy is a kind of perjury, of course, because no one is really forthright. I mean, it's the nature of the beast. But I think Maduro saying this publicly is also making a pitch to those inside the U.S. camp meaning not necessarily Americans, but other countries that have gone along. Look, we're willing to negotiate. We don't need to have this end up in civil war or a massive invasion or another U.S. war, this time in the Western Hemisphere. There's another way. We're even willing to meet with Elliot Abrams, and he can come and talk to us. Now, that's a pitch to those inside the American-led coalition of the bribed and coerced who might be able to be picked away by Venezuela and told, look, don't do it. Don't let John Bolton be your president. You know, because that's what the message is.
And may I add something to that, too? The press here in the United States has been focused on diplomacy coming from the State Department and the National Security Council, that 50 countries lined up to oppose the Maduro government and to side with the United States. Well, guess what? The Venezuelans have been just as active diplomatically, and 50 countries have signed on with them,
right,
to oppose the imposition of Juan Guaido. Well, at the White House, they have to be seeing this, even if the American press isn't covering it. And so they have to say, oh, wait a minute, our coalition of the willing or whatever it is.
Bribed and coerced.
The bribed and coerced. This isn't working out the way it was supposed to. We better start talking to the Venezuelans.
Yeah. And this, all of that plays into putting the Trump administration on its heels when they have to answer for all of this publicly. How do you continue to say that Maduro is an evil dictator who, you know, wants to destroy his country and doesn't care about his people, and he's the reason we're about to send the military in to overthrow him, when Maduro himself is saying, well, no, I'll meet with the war criminal from your administration if it keeps your military from over the I'll talk to anybody. I mean, so how the administration can't answer for, you know, 50 countries standing in solidarity with Venezuela when at the same time the same administration is saying that Venezuela has isolated itself because of Maduro, or Maduro has isolated Venezuela. Well, clearly he hasn't.
That's the voice of Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. You can hear their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek. He is a Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear, talking about how everything's not going perfectly for the Trump administration in terms of international diplomacy. Let's turn to the Warsaw Conference, the conference that took place this week in Warsaw, Poland. And Poland has a very, very right-wing government. This conference was supposed to be the big denouement, the big sort of knife in the heart of the Iran nuclear arms deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The U.S. was going to rally the rest of the world, including those who had been firmly supporting the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, and making it clear to them that the deal was done, get ready for war with Iran. Anyway, let's listen to an audio clip. This is, you'll recognize the voice. It's our Vice President, Mike Pence.
Sadly, some of our leading European partners have not been nearly as cooperative. In fact, they've led the effort to create mechanisms to break up our sanctions. Just 2 weeks ago, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom announced the creation of a special financing mechanism designed to oversee a mirror image transaction that would replace sanctionable international payments between EU businesses and Iran. They call this scheme a special purpose vehicle. We call it an effort to break American sanctions against Iran's murderous revolutionary regime. It's an ill-advised step that will only strengthen Iran, weaken the EU, and create still more distance between Europe and the United States.
Shortly after that, the foreign ministers of several countries had their knees broken, Jackie. I mean, come on, that sounded like organized crime, like your step is ill-advised. Hide your children.
That was a straight mafia kind of threat from Mike Pence. Unfortunately, or fortunately, European leaders, I think France and Germany, didn't even send their representatives to this meeting. That's how little respect they have for, I think, Pence in particular, this administration, and the United States's under Trump's move to pull out of this deal. These other countries are not going to be bullied by Trump in damaging their own economic relationships with Iran. just because the United States says they're supposed to. And Pence is really not good at being a mafia boss. He's really...
He's got the stare down, the icy stare, the steely eyes.
It's not very effective because the EU, European countries are not going to hamstring themselves economically to cede to Trump's warmongering against Iran. They're not going to do it.
Walter, he says, you call it this, but this is an effort to undermine our sanctions. It's kind of like you're hurting our little puppy.
like the sanctions, like anybody has even ruled on the legality of these sanctions in the first place. Yeah. They're not legal.
Right. You've heard our sanctions. These countries are the principal signers with the United States during the Obama administration of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The deal was this. Iran was allowing intrusive, perhaps the most intrusive inspections of any country ever, perhaps with the exception of Iraq during the Saddam Hussein period. Iran would absolutely pledge and have verified that it wasn't building a nuclear weapon. And in return, all of the signers, including the European countries and the United States, would start to lift these punishing economic sanctions that are making life so hard for Iranian people. That's the deal. Iran lived up to its deal, its side of the deal. The Atomic Energy Agency, International Atomic Energy Agency, said Iran had lived up to its side of the deal. It's the United States that violated the deal. And now Mike Pence goes and says, how dare you harm our sanctions? I mean, it's so imperialist. I mean, it really is like 19th century imperialism where the leaders actually spoke like this.
Yeah, it is. And if you want to look at it from the point of view of legality, I mean, the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, it was endorsed by the UN Security Council. It was given the seal of approval of the Security Council, which is sort of like the ultimate thing you can get to enshrine something into international law. And so the United States and Mike Pence going around and saying, well, look, you're undermining our policy, meaning that you have to force your people to also not do business or conduct any trade with Iran, you know, it goes beyond just, you know, what would already be an unjust policy of the United States saying, well, you know, companies in the U.S. can't do business with Iran. But they're saying that every other country in the world has to follow the exact same policy that we're imposing, that which will result in, by the way, I mean, enormous suffering for the Iranian people. I mean, it's already, you know, been some pain for sure as a consequence of the sanctions. You know, the availability of medicine is because, you know, it's becoming more scarce. Prices are going up. And that's what the purpose of these sanctions are in the first place. It's the same thing as the sanctions against Venezuela, which, by the way, are costing the country $30 million a day by some estimates. You know, it's the same idea because the what the United States wants Iran to do. And that's why Mike Pence talks about, you know, the Iranian people rising up and demanding freedom and all this nonsense rhetoric is because they want to make life unlivable for the ordinary Iranians. And then to try to, you know, foment some sort of crisis, internal crisis that would allow them to overthrow the government.
John, the U.S. had Israel firmly in its camp and had the Saudis firmly in their camp.
Yep.
That's about it.
That's pretty much it.
I mean, it was a pretty bad showing. I mean, this conference went off the rails.
Well, there's always a handful of countries that tries hard to pander to the United States. We've seen this really, especially since the Bush administration, with the new Europe versus old Europe. So you're going to get a whole bunch of right and far right wing countries, Hungary, Poland, maybe Romania. And then, you know, the usual cast of characters, Israel, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. And then the usuals, Tuvalu, Tahiti, the Marshall Islands, countries nobody ever heard of. That's where the support is internationally for the United States on these issues.
And John, I want to ask you a quick follow-up question. I know time is running short here. At the same time this conference went off, this anti-Iran conference went off the rails, it also came out in the media that the U.S. has been sabotaging the Iran's missile program. That was a big story.
Yes.
At the same time, and this was just 2 days ago, there was a terrorist attack in Iran.
Yes.
20 members of the Revolutionary Guard were killed in a suicide attack. It feels like the U.S. and its allies, this is the full court press on Iran. But again, I don't see it succeeding.
Oh, I don't see it succeeding. No. Listen, if the Iranians didn't collapse in the immediate aftermath of the revolution, they're not going to collapse now. There's no way. The whole economy has become normalized. The Iranians are far tougher than a lot of people give them credit for being. They know what sanctions are like. They've become accustomed to living under sanctions.
1 minute left. Walter, you're an expert on Spain and Spanish politics. What's going on? What's new? 1 minute.
There's going to be elections at the end of April. The government is a minority government led by Pedro Sanchez. He's a member of the Spanish Socialist Workers Party. Sounds super radical. It's not at all. It's just a mainstream centrist party. They were relying on other parties, especially those from the Catalonia region, to vote in favor of their proposals. They tried to pass a budget. Because there's this show trial, this political trial of Catalan political leaders and pro-independence political figures, those parties said, no, we're not going to vote for your budget. And so there was no choice but to call snap elections.
The people in Catalonia, those politicians who are in jail and others who are probably going to go to prison unless something happens, they're facing like decades in jail because they held a referendum.
It was just a vote. I mean, it was an unapproved referendum, unapproved by the central government in Madrid. You know, whatever you think, yes or no, it's a good idea for Catalonia to become independent. I mean, a lot of people were just completely outraged that, you know, people were being beaten bloody by riot police just because they were trying to vote.
Yeah, Franco is dead, but Spanish fascism, it lives on, at least in those advocating this ultra-centralized Spanish state. We're out of time. We were talking with Jacqueline Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of the Lookman Nation. She joined us here in the studio. You can hear the live stream of Lookman Nation every week on Facebook and YouTube. We were also joined in studio by Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst and a producer of this show, Loud and Clear. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and you want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.